Good evening. Good to be with you this evening. Great to have received the invitation from Don, as well as from the elders of the congregation. Greatly appreciated on my part. Always a blessing to be able to come back. The only regret I have tonight, and it's a true regret, and that is that Judy is not with me. Was not able to come on this trip. She has to be down here next week to take care of her some stuff for her dad, who is now 98, had his 98th birthday, and still living in town, and we're grateful for that. It does remind me, though, because his sister passed away about a year ago. She was 104. Judy's grandmother was 100, so I've got no chance of outliving Judy, that much I know. It runs in their family, the longevity of life for sure. But she regrets also not being able to be here. We're going to take a few moments tonight to deal with a subject that is, it's difficult on some levels, not necessarily on all levels. As you'll see in a moment, we're going to read just a few passages together quickly, because I think there are some things that God says on this subject that just say, all right, we can take that part of the equation and just be done with it immediately if we want to be honest with ourselves. The title is Keeping Sex Sacred. And so as we think about that, if you look in the dictionary, just a regular dictionary, we're told sacred means dedicated or set apart for the service or worship of a deity. Now, I would just tell you, when the sentence is keeping sex sacred, already just having that definition makes it seem just a little bit awkward, how we think in those kinds of terms, or worthy of religious veneration or holy. And so unusual is that concept, thinking in terms of things that are so physical as the sexual union and intimacy that God talks about in his scriptures, and spiritual things that it's hard to figure out how they fit sometimes in the same picture. I'd ask you to take a look at that list. Faith, love, hope, forgiveness, sanctification, purity, righteousness, justice, sexuality. And then if you were to answer these two questions in your mind, which of those is most spiritual? And we would probably battle a little bit trying to figure out, all right, so I wonder which one I would say is most spiritual in its concept out of that list, because there's so many that are equally spiritual there. But then if you ask the question, which is least, people would normally gravitate toward the last item on the list. We don't think of the sacredness or the spiritualness of something like the sexual union that God has created. And part of that is the very reason that we are doing, or that you're doing, this series that you're doing, as we think about the concept of culture and how it affects us when we are thinking about this particular topic. I want you to turn to just a few passages real quickly with me. We're not going to spend much time on them, because I think that they are very easy for those who are dedicated to Christ. Those who have said, I want to live my life in such a way as to be pleasing to God. When Paul wrote to the Corinthians, he said, as in all things, we aim to please God. So if that's my goal, if that's what I'm striving for as a Christian, to truly live my life in order to please God, which I think is the goal of Christianity, even more so than people will talk about what's your goal for Christianity, heaven. I think heaven's a reward. The goal is to live godlike and godly and live a righteous life. He will reward us if we live the way he's asked us to live. One is a reward. One's really a goal. And I think that our goal should be to live godly. In Ephesians chapter 5, in verse 3, Paul writes to those brethren and says, but fornication and all uncleanness or covetousness, let it not even be named among you as is fitting. You ever remember talking to your children about anything and just saying, that's just not right? We don't do that because it's just not right. It's not the way we behave. That's what Paul's saying. He's saying this is not, that kind of behavior is just not fitting for a Christian. When he uses that word porneia, which is translated here fornication, but really has an application to any of the things that are involved in sexual immorality. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, where he tells us very similar fashion when he writes to those brethren, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, and again in verse 3, for this is the will of God, your sanctification, that you should abstain from sexual immorality. that each of you should know how to possess your own vessel in sanctification and in honor, not in passion of lust like the Gentiles who do not know God. In other places as well, in Matthew chapter 15, Jesus tells us that fornication and sexual immorality, those are things that they happen because we have a heart that's focused the wrong direction. He said they proceed out of the heart. In other words, I'm not thinking correctly. I'm not only not acting correctly, my heart's not pure the way that it should be. If my heart was absolutely pure in seeking Christ, he's saying, then it wouldn't allow me to be led that same direction, that same way. And so he's saying those are heart issues. In 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 9, he tells us that we need to understand that those people who are involved in sexual immoral practices, sexual immorality, fornication, and adultery, says they will not inherit the kingdom of God. And so it'd be difficult, I think, for God to express in any more certain terms the idea of, if you want to just talk about the morality, whether you're talking about pre-marriage or you're talking about outside of your marriage, sexual immorality, adultery, or fornication, God is saying, there's not a question here that we can debate, is this right or is this not right? There was a religious body a few years ago that debated that subject. Their council at their particular body debated the subject whether or not premarital sexual relations should be accepted, and they actually decided that they should, provided certain conditions were met, such as the couple was truly in love. That's not a debatable topic. God says fornication is wrong, period. And so as Christians, if we want to just deal with the side of it that talks about the morality, it's kind of like when we used to deal with our children. Not about this subject in particular, but any subject. Children do things they shouldn't do. And they do them in different ways. Sometimes they do things they shouldn't do because they just don't know they shouldn't do it. And they have to be taught a lesson. Sometimes they're just irresponsible. And if a child is irresponsible and does something that is wrong, we treat that differently than if a child is in direct disobedience to something we have told them, do we not? If our children directly disobey us as parents, we feel that there needs to be a different kind of punishment for direct disobedience than an irresponsible type of behavior that we're trying to correct. I think God would be saying the same thing to us, because to as a Christian, to feel that I could be involved in anything of a sexually immoral way is not an issue of irresponsibility, if I have looked at his word. It's really direct disobedience to what God has said. So I say all of that because I'm just saying I want to put that part of this equation aside. We're not here to debate tonight whether premarital sexual relations are wrong or extramarital sexual relations are wrong. That's an easy yes, they are, and we move on from that subject. What I want to do is deal with what makes them so wrong. Why is it that God deals with them the way that he does? And so I want us to think in these terms. There's two sides of this. There's probably not any subject in our society today wherein the pendulum has swung farther in both directions than it has on this particular subject. And so it makes it difficult because we hear a lot of different things, we're exposed to a lot of different things, and it makes it difficult sometimes to understand where do we belong in that whole picture. And so I want to talk first about not what's the biggest influence on us, but what has created, at least in the minds of some throughout history, a concept that is at best fearful, and maybe at worst, it is just completely against the concept of even discussing this topic, and especially amongst those that are Christians. And so we fear or despise sometimes the topic, which I think is having its recourse in a bad way on the children that we're raising if we won't talk honestly and openly about what God says about this subject. And I'll explain why that is in just a moment. It was once seen as just automatically more spiritual to be somebody who completely abstained from sexual relations. And I'm not talking about just outside of marriage. I'm talking about in place of marriage. And so there was a whole time in history where those who abstained and those who never got married, those who lived celibate, were automatically assumed to be driving toward more spirituality, and they were the more spiritual people until they would eventually have union with God. Augustine, who had a very debauched life and left that for a life of celibacy, could not believe in his own mind that you could truly be spiritual and in fact have the urges or desires sexually that are in us. So he said those two are incompatible. You could not be spiritual and have those particular urges. And so it was his position that even within marriage, the sexual union was still sinful, except for procreation. So if you were going to have relations with your spouse in order to produce children, that was acceptable. But for any other reason at all, it was considered sin. He said the apostle enjoined them, not as a command, but conceded as a favor to have sexual intercourse, even without the purpose of procreation. Although evil habits impel them to such intercourse, marriage protects them from adultery and fornication. For this is not permitted because of the marriage, but because of the marriage is pardoned. So he's saying it's still not right. He goes on to say, in marriage, intercourse for the purpose of generation has no fault attached to it, but for the purpose of satisfying concupiscence provided with a spouse because of marriage fidelity, it is a venial sin. Adultery or fornication, however, is a mortal sin. So that was his position, as well as Jerome and some others that wrote at those times. And so they said, even within marriage, that was a problem. If that's the case, I would tell you, here's the biggest problem with that. It seems to go directly in conflict with the very nature of God's creation. I want you to think about a particular statement, and we'll come back to it in a minute. Just all together in the scriptures in Genesis 1, when it's recorded that we are created in the image of God, male and female, he created them. We're going to come back to that double statement in a minute, because I would tell you that the statement itself can be confusing if we don't understand what he's trying to get us to understand about the nature of this. So I would tell you that's probably not our biggest issue, is what the church fathers say. But think in terms of the command that God gave man and woman to be fruitful and multiply, the very first command he gave them after he created them, brought them together. Be fruitful and multiply. Would it not seem odd that God would give them a command that would drive them farther away from him? It just seems odd that he would be telling them to do something that would make them less spiritual rather than more spiritual. He said that a man shall leave his father and mother. He said he shall cling to his wife. They were both naked and not ashamed. Those scriptures aren't pitted against one another. I think they're absolutely in harmony with one another if we have the view that God would have us to have. Secondly, it swings the other direction. Our culture. We could spend probably the entire summer series talking about the faults our culture has regarding this subject matter. But it is a culture that is now becoming an absolutely anything goes culture when you talk about this particular subject, is it not? A culture that redefines everything, including marriage itself, that redefines gender itself. God created them male and female, so there's not a lot of options there. God created them. Society does not make that determination. But our society is consumed. Our culture is consumed. If you had a mind to, and I'm not encouraging you to do this, but if you had a mind to and you just typed in something along this subject in Google, I'm just telling you, you'll literally get millions of hits. Just type in sex or sexuality. It's endless. the amount of hits that are going to come up, because we're in a culture that is so consumed by that because of its views on things as well as the pornographic content that is there. So as a separate item, I would tell you, and we teach this at every retreat we are at normally, almost every seminar we do, we talk about the absolute necessity to have a good, strong, accountable internet filter on your computer system, especially if you have children in the home, especially, or grandchildren ever come to your home. I know even now, as I'll be doing something on the computer or doing something on my phone, and I get hung up and can't figure something out, I get one of my grandkids, like 8 years old, who's saying, "Grandpa, let me take care of that for you." They have no issues with the computer. They can do things with the computer that I can't do, and they therefore could access things that, if we didn't prevent that by filtering it, things that we wouldn't want them to access. One phrase that should help us understand the culture view towards sexuality: two consenting adults. That's the only requirement. So they're saying anything outside of forcing yourself on somebody, anything else virtually is acceptable. And we say two consenting of adults. Do you know what the age of consent is in the United States of America? It's not really adults. Age of consent is 16 in the United States of America right now. Age of consent in other countries, there are 29 countries where it's 14. So you think it's going to be 16 forever in this country, the way that we are headed? There are four countries where it is 13, including larger countries like Japan. Two countries where it is 12, one where it is 11. That's the age of consent. That's the statistics from 2022 in these different countries. There are like 9 countries that it's not permissible outside of marriage. 9 in the whole world. But 9 where it's not even permissible outside of marriage as far as the country is concerned. Here's an article that was written by a lady by the name of Jessica Booth called 8 Reasons It's Okay to Have a Casual Hookup. Here's what I really want to make clear. Having a casual hookup doesn't mean you're a bad person. It means you want to have a no strings attached sex, and that's your right. You should never let anyone make you feel bad about that. She goes on to list the 8 reasons. She starts with: sex feels good, and when you feel good, you feel happier, right? So I'm saying that's the culture that we're in. We understand how bad the culture is. Our problem is not, the culture is our problem, because we fight against the culture all the time and allowing it to affect us. It's not really the church fathers, but it becomes a reaction to our culture. Because our culture has gone so far this way, we don't want to deal with the subject at all. And that's the part I was talking about before. Are we talking to our children about what God has said about this subject and how pure and holy the concept is and how God's not afraid to deal with this subject in the scriptures? It's important that we do that. So we're not influenced by the church fathers as much as we are by culture or reaction to culture. We either swallow up what culture says, or we so react that we overreact and we just don't want to deal with it at all. Here's how I know that's true. I'm going to give you an example of 2 couples that I have dealt with in recent years. I always hesitate to say the opportunity. It is an opportunity, but it's not a fun one to meet with couples who are in marital distress. And because we've done marriage seminars for the last 20-some years, we have opportunity to do that more frequently than I would like to do, I can tell you that. There are more Christian couples that are struggling than we probably think that there are struggling. But in these 2 couples, one of them had been married for 12 years. 12 years. She would not, after 12 years, would not allow her husband to see her naked, because she felt that was just dirty, that he was... found her appealing, and that he liked to look at her form. And so she would not allow him to see her for 12 years after marriage. I understand that's an extreme, but I'm saying she got that idea from somewhere. I just dealt with a couple that just got married, and the girl came to me, they both came to me, but she was just beside herself because now she was married and she was afraid about everything about this subject and also did not want to allow. She goes, I've never allowed a man to see me that way before. All of a sudden now, what am I supposed to do? Just act like it doesn't matter? No, it does matter. You need to have the right view of it so that you can understand, I think, what God would have. It doesn't mean it removes all the concern and tension. But if we get the right view, we have a better understanding of what God would have us to do. It would seem that those two views are absolutely, totally separate from one another. They're poles apart, culture and an overreaction to culture. But I would tell you, legitimately, they're one issue here. One issue. And that is that it's too narrow of a viewpoint. Oops. Let me see if I can go back. There's that. Nope. We don't want that. That's what we want. Too narrow of a viewpoint. That they're only seeing part of the picture. The culture, we understand that. Culture is not nearly concerned with relationship. I did a search on which countries are most liberal in their view. I didn't even realize this. Iceland universally takes an opinion that you should have intimacy and sexual relations before you date. That way you know whether or not you want to date somebody. That's their position on that. They said that's what you're interested in. Well, this is this narrow viewpoint as to what it's even about. What is it that God would have us to understand? The lyrics of a song that were produced in 2009 says, "You and me, baby, ain't nothing but mammals, so let's do it like they do on the Discovery Channel." And I would tell you, that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with those who feel that it is somehow either dirty or ungodly over here, or those who feel like we're just animals, so what difference does it make? We should just do whatever we want to do because it is pleasurable to us. Both have the same issue. They're looking at this relationship and this gift that God has provided to us as if it is a purely physical thing. That's the only thing that they're seeing. But they're missing the point, and this is where I want to spend the rest of our time tonight. There's one solution to that. You need to see it the way God sees it. It's a lot deeper subject than just what you see at the surface. That picture of that iceberg on the previous page, same iceberg. But can you imagine if you're in a huge ship heading toward that iceberg, there's a tendency to think, well, that's not so big. We're okay. The Titanic, I don't think, saw the iceberg that they hit. But I assure you, it's like all the rest of them. It doesn't look above the surface like it looks below the surface. You need to understand there's a lot more to it than we're seeing sometimes. And I think that's the way with the sexual relationship. And if I'm going to keep it sacred, dedicated to God, I need to have an understanding, I think, of what it is that God was trying to do for me. So what is His design? What does His word say about it? What am I supposed to learn about it or gain from this? Is it for producing offspring or producing pleasure? Yes. God designed both. God made us the way that He made us, in His image, and yet male and female. How do you get into your own mind those two statements together? In the image of God, and yet sexual creatures. You realize God didn't have to make us that way. God did not have to make us the way that He did. And even having made us sexual creatures, He did not have to make us to where it would be pleasurable. He could have made it where it was only a way of producing offspring, but we received nothing from that by way of pleasure, if that's what He had wanted to do. But He did not. God created something that I think He gave to us within the confines of marriage that was this incredible gift that we are to be stewards over and appreciative of because it helps us to understand some things that we might not understand. The fact that Adam and Eve were in the image of God and yet male and female, I think speaks of a relationship human between the two of them and relationship spiritual between them and God. We have a spiritual relationship and a human relationship. And here's where this helps me. Years ago, as we were doing one of the seminars, I had come across a book that just asked a question. I thought, wow, what a great question and how that helped me. In Ephesians 5, when Paul writes there, you have that whole explanation of husbands loving their wives and wives submitting to their husbands and all that teaching on marriage. And he gets to the end of it and he says what? He says, got a revelation for you here. We're not really talking about marriage. All those things are true about marriage, but that wasn't the point. He said, I speak concerning Christ and the church. And so I'm seeing things about marriage and what he's asking me to do as a husband in my marriage, what he's asking my wife to do in our marriage. And as we form that bond the way that God would have us to form that bond, I think there are things that we learn. God speaks about his relationship to us as being married to us throughout the Old and New Testament. And he says wonderful things. Through the prophet Isaiah, he says, God rejoices over you like a bridegroom rejoices over his bride. Judy and I got married at the Temple Terrace building, not this one, the old one. And I can still remember her dad, J.D., walking her down the aisle. Because, you know, in those days, you never saw your spouse before, on the wedding day, before she came down the aisle. And she came through those doors. I thought two things. I thought, I am one of the luckiest men in the world. I probably should rephrase that. I am the luckiest man in the world. Probably too late because Judy will have already had an opportunity to hear that. Luckiest man in the world because I thought she is beautiful and I am so thankful for this day. And you get that picture in Isaiah of God rejoicing over his people like a bridegroom over his bride. And then I thought, man, she's clenched onto her dad's arm like she doesn't even want to come down that aisle. So she did. She came down, made it down. We got married and we've been married for 45 years. And we're grateful for that. God has blessed us richly in that relationship. But I've learned some things. Because I am married, I've learned some things about God. There was an author who said, how many of you, once you got married, learned something about your spouse that you didn't know before? Could you answer that question? Nod your head or anything else? Yeah, we learned. But then it says, more importantly, who learned something about yourself that you didn't know before? Absolutely. Gary and Betsy Ricucci, who wrote a book on marriage, said, God's best wedding gift was a full-length mirror called your spouse saying, here's to finding out what you're truly like. We do. We learn things about ourselves. But because of that, I learned some things about my God. Because I learned in being in a relationship that is 24/7, that is every day of the week, all throughout the year and throughout the years, living in a relationship that is that intimate, that close, I learned that it takes a lot of forgiveness for a marriage to work. And so how much forgiveness does God have to have? See, I understand him as a forgiving God better because I'm married than I did before I was married, or patience, or other things. Well, is there anything I can learn from this particular aspect of our marriage, from the sexual side of marriage? Is there anything possibly that God would have me to learn by being both this spiritual and this sexual creature that he has made me? He made us with the drives that we have, with the hormones that we have, with the parts that we have. I mean, I don't mean to be crude. I'm just saying God made us the way he made us. And he said within marriage in Hebrews chapter 13, within marriage, that the sexual union is an honorable thing. It is a good thing. It was created. He says, let it be kept that way. That it is a wonderful gift from our God. But the Bible uses pretty definitive language in different places. Hard for us sometimes. I mean, Song of Solomon is pretty explicit as far as the way it is talking about things. And I love the descriptions as you get that imagery of that physical intimacy and all that goes there. How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O prince's daughter. The curves of your hips are like jewels, the work of the hands of an artist. Your navel is like a round goblet, which never lacks mixed wine. Your belly is like a heap of wheat fenced about with lilies. Now, I'm not suggesting you use this wording when you're talking to your wife. If I told Judy her belly was like a heap of wheat, I'd never get anything said beyond that. We would have to discuss that. But he goes on to say specifically, or he says, your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Or in other places, God talks about how visual he expects that we are. And he says, let her breast satisfy you or fulfill you all the days of your life. He's saying, I made her form to appeal to you that way. That's not That's not a dirty thing. Her form, my desire, my form, her desire. God created all of those things in order that we could have that relationship. And so, what do I learn? Here's a passage that I never thought I would have any application to marriage or the intimacy of the sexual union until I did this lesson. In John chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. And verse 14 tells us what? Tells us that the Word became flesh. I would tell you that is God becoming absolutely one with man in every sense of the word. That is a complete oneness. The kind of oneness that existed between the Godhead. Jesus said he and the Father were one, but now Jesus and mankind were also one. And in Genesis chapter 1, what does he tell us that we are striving for? In Genesis chapter 2. He says, you shall leave father and mother, you shall cling to your spouse or your wife in that particular passage, and the two shall become one flesh. That is not an occurrence that happens in a moment of time, though it may include that. I think it includes the sexual union, but I don't think that's a reference specifically only to the sexual union. I think he says, we'll become. That's a process. Judy and I are much more one now in flesh and in all ways than we were the day we got married. We have continued to grow together and to learn more about each other and become more vulnerable and open and trusting of each other, more sacrificial with each other, more loving in that relationship so that we become one just more and more with each passing day. And what does that help me understand? I think it helps me understand something about the oneness with my God. And the whole concept of Christ and his church. I speak concerning Christ and his church. There will be a day where we get to go home, and there will be a large wedding feast, the wedding supper of the Lamb, and we will be at last completely one with our Lord. And I think marriage and the whole sexual union is a bond that God has created that helps us to see that and to understand that. So that as I become absolutely bound to my wife physically, emotionally, in every respect, I understand something about my God and his bond to me. I think God intended it to be sacrificial, the sexual union, to be sacrificial, permanent, loving, and exclusive. And I think it may possibly be the single best physical parallel of the complete unity that is shared within the Godhead. Best physical parallel. He intended it to be in marriage because of it creating that bond. He intended that it help us to be joined together as close, not only physically, but emotionally and spiritually as we could possibly be in that relationship. I think God would have us to grasp that it's related to our spiritual relationship. Just think of these kinds of words: trust, openness, closeness, honesty, intimacy, vulnerability, passion, desire, connection. All of those could be used of my relationship with my God. And I think all of those could and should be used of my relationship with my wife. And I think he created sexual union in order to allow me to get to the absolute fulfillment of all of those things. And so I think it's pleasing to God, and we need to help our children understand there is a pure side of it. There is a spiritual side of it. It is a God-given gift, and it will help you to understand your God even better. Save yourself for marriage, because that's the only place that God intends that to be fulfilled. And I think that's because he knows it creates that same bond even outside of marriage. He talks about you join yourself to a harlot. There are things that happen when you're in the physical union and intimacy that God intended to only happen within marriage. And so the greatest significance is not, in fact, what it accomplishes on an earthly plane, but I think what it images on a spiritual or a divine plane. It is a picture of the oneness that I can have with my God throughout my life. And so he wants us to see it as absolutely sacred, as a spiritual act, not only a physical act, which I would tell you would help us to understand why you cannot objectify your partner. You can't treat them as an object, because it is an unspiritual concept to treat somebody else as an object. It is not only a physical act, it is very much a spiritual act. I liked one guy's description as he described what it's like to have better intimacy or sexual union in a relationship. He said, it's not an athletic feat to achieve, but a spiritual connection to be more fully expressed. I think we can learn something about our God and appreciate the gift that God has given us. I want to read you one further quote, and the lesson will be yours. C.S. Lewis, I think, understood what the problem was when you got outside of marriage, whether before or after. He said, the monstrosity of sexual intercourse outside of marriage is that those who indulge in it are trying to isolate one kind of union, the sexual, from all the other kinds of union which were intended to go along with it and make up the total union. And I think that's what God would have us to understand in that relationship. It is a total union. I need to appreciate that and the gift that he has provided. He invented it for us, for our benefit. And he wants us to appreciate it and to appreciate him as we understand him better. I would encourage you, not only with sexual union, every aspect of your marriage, seek to see if you can understand the ways that it will help you understand your God better because you have that marriage. I appreciate so much your attention tonight.